Online, and this is the Sunday night edition of TS Radio. Of course, tonight we're going to be talking about issues dealing with guardianship and the abuse of our elderly. We've all been watching as through our, each of our states, various pieces of legislation have been promoted and come up that extend the privileges of the predatory guardians. And one recently came to light here in New Mexico, and it's a bill that it's Senate Bill 112 in New Mexico, and it's in committee now being considered. And what this does is extend the benefits of being a predatory guardian for 6 months to a year past the actual physical death of the victim. I am assuming this is safe to make sure that if they weren't able to loot the entire estate before the person died, they've got 6 months to a year to get the job done. As most of you know, in these probate courts, the first thing they want to know is, have all the assets been marshaled? In other words, have you collected every possible asset this person that we are holding prisoner, forcibly medicating, isolating from their family and friends, levying charges against family members that have no evidence or proof these things ever happened? Have you got everything lined up? Because we don't want to miss a penny. Everybody's making a buck.
You know,
the court gets... Go ahead.
Marty, this is Beverly. I wanted to say with respect to that point that they also have another avenue that they take, which is to know that there are assets out there and not to put them on any accounting at all. So in other words, those assets are available, but the court supposedly doesn't know about them, and the family members don't know about them. And I've seen that in our case many times, that there were cash value life insurance policies out there that we did not know about. There were very, very expensive jewelry out there, assets that we did not know about. And in fact, there were many bank accounts that at the beginning of the guardianship, the guardian did not list.
That's a very frequent occurrence, and sometimes they actually put on a report to the court that they've opened a vault, but they don't tell the court the contents.
Exactly.
Okay, and for everyone who's listening, the lady you just heard speak is our guest for this evening. Her name is Leonie Rosensteel, and she's from New Mexico. She has been involved in these issues with guardianship abuse over the years, and you've actually testified, haven't you?
Yes, I did. I testified in November before a legislative subcommittee, and it was a subcommittee that dealt with it was specifically dealing with disabilities, but a subcategory of that would be both a developmentally disabled person who has never been able to make a will or be fully legally considered able to do things on his or her own, and people who have become incapacitated for one reason or another due to age or illness or whatever. And I was testifying primarily about people who have come under guardianship after being fully in command of their powers and have left testaments, have left documents, wills, or powers of attorney that the courts are routinely ignoring. They just simply ignore anybody who's a relative if the person has assets. I went back and traced some of the history of the whole problem, and they're really two complementary, or they're horrible, but they work together. They're synergistic. One of them is the fact that in the 19th century, anybody who had any kind of mental problem was locked away from the world, and it was supposed to be kept secret, and the family thought it was a horrible thing and tried to keep anybody from knowing. The second thing is that in the 1980s, some of the laws changed and permitted commercial guardians to come in. Before that, it was mostly a family member or someone who was a friend of the judge, and the judge wanted to appoint them, and they became the guardian. But in the 1980s, it became really, really strongly commercial. And I actually found some articles in newspapers everywhere from California to Florida talking about this new industry that was starting up because the baby boomers were going to get older, and they were specifically targeting at that point people with $500,000 or more in assets, and that would probably include their homes as well because those are assets too.
And Leonie,
if you account for inflation, that would probably be about $1 million today. And those are the people they're targeting. They also target indigent people because the state collects money and the state has contracts with commercial guardians to take care of those people too. They're not.
So under commercial guardians, you are grouping both what we call here in Florida professional guardians and also public guardians. That's what you are terming as commercial guardians.
Yes, because they're both actually living from the proceeds of taking care of other people.
Right. In other words, non-familial guardians.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And that, see, this is what gets me. Some people, Leonie and Beverly, seem to think that this is a sporadic problem. It just occurs here or there. It's nothing to worry about. It'll be taken care of. Well, it won't. And it isn't sporadic. It is happening across the country in every state, in every county and city. It is happening.
It is systemic.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And one of the biggest aspects of the problem and the thing that enables this to happen most regularly is the fact of secrecy. And I alluded to that before when I was talking about in the 19th century they wanted to keep it secret. At the legislative hearing that I went to in November, one of the things that happened was that two officials from the State Guardianship Association went up after the discussion and after the presentations. They didn't speak in public. They went up afterwards and spoke to the chair of the committee and said to her, it was absolutely mandatory that all of these proceedings be kept absolutely secret. It was for the protection of the ward. Now, if you go out to a restaurant or you go out to a public place, you will very often see there people who clearly have attendants with them. For one reason or another, whether it's a physical problem or a mental or emotional problem, they're considered to require the services of somebody to be there to help them all the time. Now, you can see those things without having an ad in the paper saying John Smith has just been declared incapacitated. It's perfectly obvious. There are people in restaurants. There are people walking down the street. And they clearly have attendants. So unless they're going to keep these people locked away in a, you know, in a turret somewhere, people are going to know when they see a person with an attendant that that person needs help.
But you really don't see wards. That's exactly the point. They are not out in the public. They very, very often are locked inside of nursing homes. Here in Florida, it is extremely rare for a ward ever to get out of a nursing home. Extremely rare. And once they're in the nursing homes, they are literally kept in there virtually all of the time.
I've known people who were isolated and locked in both in their own private homes and in nursing homes.
Absolutely.
And sometimes they will employ someone in order to bleed the estate who will come and be an attendant. I mean, this is my characterization, to bleed the estate, because the people who are being invited into that person's home are not people that person would necessarily interact with socially. They're paid attendants.
And
in lieu of their own family, who often live nearby and are not allowed to go see them.
How much are they getting
paid
in New Mexico, the attendants? What do they get versus the agency? Because in Florida, it's outrageous.
Oh, it's going to vary widely from $13 an hour to maybe $25 an hour. And I can't prove this at this moment, but there's very often a discrepancy between the amount that's paid and the amount that the person who is actually doing the work is getting a nominal wage. The
agency
is getting a lot of money.
Here they get what they call certified nursing assistants, CNAs,
mm-hmm.
get approximately $10 an hour. The agency, on the other hand, gets $21. So...
Mm-hmm. Well, we have what are called home health aides, which are a step below CNAs and are not supposed to administer prescription drugs at all.
CNAs in our state are not allowed to administer prescription drugs.
Okay, well, CNAs are allowed to administer prescription drugs, but home health aides, theoretically, if the person's not able to do that for themselves, they can put the drug in front of them, but they can't put it in their mouth if they
okay.
don't want to take it.
Yes.
One thing I wanted to put in here, Leonie, you and I had discussed something you have there in New Mexico that I haven't found here in Minnesota, which is called Agent in Place, and you said that there is no oversight at all for
these agents. Oh, there's absolutely, well, what it is if someone's not in a group home, there's no oversight. If you have three or more unrelated people in a home, it becomes a group home, and then the state is required to see if there are adequate exits if someone's disabled that they can actually get out in an emergency. But in New Mexico, fewer than three people, they don't look.
Now,
and there are many people who are confined to bed or need a wheelchair, and their house does not have a safe emergency exit for them. And there
isn't
are other
that
things that are not, you know,
place?
Looked at in terms of, like, fire hazards or inadequate equipment or perhaps a wall socket when someone's on oxygen that keeps blowing, and that's a fire hazard. Any spark can ignite oxygen. I actually had a neighbor down the street who literally blew herself up. She was on oxygen. There was a spark, and her house went up. You could see the column of fire about 50 feet tall. It was terrifying, middle of the night. She did
now,
not get
is that called aging in place?
That is, well, theoretically, aging in place is supposed to be something that's very dignified where you can stay in your own home. But I
Correct.
Think these are examples of abuses of aging in place.
Okay.
This is just, you know, in looking through the New Mexico legislation, I, of course, came up here to Minnesota because apparently Senator Al Franken on the federal level has revived his February of 2012 bill, which called for increased funding for one of the worst agencies out there, which is Adult Protective Services. Where this attitude comes from in government, if we just keep throwing money at something, it'll make it better. I don't know. It is a detriment to the elder community. It is a threat to them. These people are not at all concerned about anybody's safety or health or well-being. They're concerned about meeting their quota and collecting their paycheck. And
well,
that's
I can
it.
Tell
I
you an example of that that's not on the forbidden list for me, and that is some years ago I reported a nursing home to my state elder care abuse agency. And the reason why I did was that I was visiting someone there when dinner was served, and what came for dinner, and I'd been hearing from people at that home that they were not being fed, and I thought, well, that's strange. And I was there, and I saw something come in on a tray, and it looked like a thimble full of soup. It was like a large thimble. And I said to the aide who delivered it, what's that? And he said, oh, that's dinner. I said, dinner? I said, it looks like soup. He said, oh, that's chicken stew. I said, I don't see the stew, but I do see liquid, and I do see one piece of chicken floating in it. And he said, well, that's what the recipe said it was, and he was quite huffy about it. And at that point, I started bringing food to the facility every day to give to as many people as I could give it to because I knew they weren't being fed. I immediately complained to Adult Protective Services and said, and long-term care agency part of it, and said, these people are not being fed. Do you know, I didn't hear back from them for about 3.5 months. When they finally called me, I got really angry with them. I said, look, these people are not being fed. If I hadn't tried to do something that I could do, and I knew other people who were connected to other residents were doing something, I said, these people would all have starved to death. They later discovered that someone was stealing the food. They were buying the food, and somebody related to the institution was actually taking the deliveries and taking them somewhere else and using them for something else. But nobody knew. And we tried to, I'm sure other people tried to report it too. They did absolutely nothing for about 3.5 months. It's just horrible.
Don't you think that those families also went to the media? I know we have so many families that have gone to the media time and time again, and various media, not just one outlet. And the media absolutely censor this information from getting out into the public.
I'm familiar with several cases where there have been repeated attempts to get media attention for problems. And either they're skewed in some way when they are reported or they're not reported. And in some cases, there was one really horrible case of a guardian, and there have been several cases similar to this in New Mexico, where there is a couple that's married, and some disgruntled child from a previous marriage is irritated for some reason and has a guardianship declared. One of the first things that happens is the couple is separated.
Yes.
And whoever it is, whether it's the wife or the husband, they're taken. They're either not seen again or they're seen under very, very limited circumstances and with, you know, a monitor's presence so that they can't have a private conversation again. It's just one of the most horrible things I've ever seen, and I've now been able to identify it repeatedly, not only in New Mexico but in other states as well. Because I'm currently
very abusive to the rights of the elderly.
Absolutely. And they do the same thing with family who are in place. There are some guardian commercial, and you call them predatory, and I try not to call them predatory because it's unpleasant to do that, but they are. Some of these guardian groups that are commercial who absolutely routinely abuse the rights of all family, not just spouses, which is horrible, but all family. If they specialize in taking care of people whose family, I hate to say this, doesn't care about them. And they're routinely, you know, retained by such people. And all those people care about is what happens at the end and how much do I get. But if there are family members who are close by, they tend to deny them access. They don't want them to see their loved ones. Or they make it very, very restricted visitation, and they always want to have a monitor present so that the person can't speak their mind to a family member. It's equally abusive to be in a room with someone you care about who can't really communicate with you if they're upset about something.
And half the time they're medicated and docile.
And the other half the time they look scared to death.
Well, a lot of what they look like and act like is a direct result of the medications being forced on them. One of the things that they're, again, doing a lot of research on these psychotropic drugs that they're using on the elderly. None of them are approved for use on the elderly, and they're specifically prohibited. Haldol, Seroquel, Zyprexa, Risperdal, all of those are specifically prohibited for use on an elderly person who is exhibiting any level of dementia or Alzheimer's, and because it increases and exacerbates those symptoms, and it can cause long-term permanent damage. They do that to these people constantly. One of the upshots of that medication, among many, is this vacillation in their behavior. They're very aggressive one minute, they're docile another minute, the next minute they're crying, they're off the walls, they can become physically aggressive, they talk about suicide, they talk about murder. This is exactly what these drugs do to them, and it is exactly why it's given to them. I was looking at this bill, and it says, this is the New Mexico bill, says the provisions of subsection A of this section shall not apply when a protected person, in other words, this establishment of this long-term guardianship, when a protected person has in place at the time of death a will or trust that is valid pursuant to the provisions of the Uniform Probate Code. Now, that sounds really nice, except immediately when you go into probate court and there is a big estate that's there for the taking, and they drug these people, they said, well, they're incompetent. And even though their estate documents, their wills, their trusts, you know, whatever they were intending to do, their medical surrogacy, medical directives, everything are thrown out. Well, they're incompetent. Well, and you bring up, well, they were not incompetent 10 years ago when they set this up. Well, they are now. So now these documents don't matter. So when I see things like this included in a bill, it's just fluff and hype, because whoever wrote the bill knows damn well anybody going into a probate court with any pre-existing documents for how they want to be handled, how they want their estate handled, that all of that's off the table, it's out the door, and new documents are implemented via the court. And but nobody will address that. And what I would like to see, and I'd like both your opinions on this, is some legislation that penalizes not only the judge, but the guardian and the attorneys involved for discarding pre-existing legal documents.
I would love to see that happen. And actually, there are a couple of states, Massachusetts is one of them, that has revised some statutes recently so that that should not be allowed to happen. It says the guardian must act in accordance with the ward's previously expressed estate planning. And I've seen time and again in New Mexico that they're not respecting that. They will change how the funds are taken out. If someone says in their will, I want a particular distribution of assets, I want to create trusts after death, but during my life I want all the money for my care to come equally out of all the money that's in my estate. And they will change it to suit themselves and say, well, we're going to take this person's money before that person's money. And they exhaust one trust, and then the money that would have been in one trust, and then there's nothing for that person, which is exactly the opposite of what was in the will in the first place. And they do that while the person's alive, too. They'll have a hearing and say, we want to change the will.
Well, they also change the advance directives, the living will.
They don't care about powers of attorney.
No.
They just ignore them.
Now,
most of the time, the excuse that this is the most incredible excuse, because if it's true, if any part of this excuse is true, then parents and children should be separated at birth. Because one of the things they say is if you're a family member, you automatically have a conflict of interest. And therefore, you can't be appointed as a guardian, even if you've been managing this person's money for years, suddenly if they're incapacitated, you have a conflict of interest with them. It's insane.
And then if you try to fight what they've done, then they tell you have no standing. And
I've heard that too. Yes, we've all heard that.
I think we've got a dichotomy here between the actual law, which in many cases looks very good on paper, and the enforcement of the laws. A law that has no enforcement mechanism is essentially worthless. And this is what we're finding in guardianships across the country. Even when the laws are impeccably written, there are no enforcement mechanisms. So, with respect to your question, Marty, can we have some kind of action against the judge? Under the, I believe, United States Supreme Court case law, there is no action ever against a judge unless he has been acting outside of his jurisdiction. So if there's something he's done that under the farthest stretches of the human imagination he can't do as a judge, then there can be action. But with respect
to guardians, here's the thing on that. Those judges in family and probate courts are nudges. They are administrative officials. They do not qualify as judges. They don't have any legal training for the most part. Most of them are not a lawyer or attorney. They have been somebody's golf buddy, somebody's drinking buddy, some relation or something else, and they get appointed by the upper state courts to these positions. These are created courts. These are not courts created under the Constitution. These are administrative courts that have nothing to do with the Constitution. They deal with code and statute. And that's why
our judges here are elected. I mean,
not your probate judges.
Oh, yes.
And we have elected judges and we have appointed judges. And usually in New Mexico, if a judge is appointed, they have to have one election after that. And then usually they're in forever.
Well, what we commonly see both in Indiana and in Florida is that you have 13 openings, let's say, and 13 slated candidates for judges. So you absolutely, totally have no choice other than to do what we do, which is only vote for the judges that we personally believe are going to be decent. And the rest of them we don't vote for, but you can't vote them out in the sense that you vote for someone else because there's no one else to vote for.
Well, we theoretically have contested races, but only in certain districts. There are certain districts that are automatically Republican or Democratic districts, and there's only one candidate, and that candidate runs unopposed.
It's the same here, but still in all, these are these are actually administrative officials. They are not in reality judges. Simply because they keep listing them as judges doesn't make them judges. This is why most probate court judges don't have an oath of office on file, because they're not judges. And they're not required.
I'd like to go back to the idea of enforcement, because Arizona made some changes recently that created the possibility of having citizen monitors who are trained by the court but are not paid, so it's not a big drain on the state's budget.
Yes.
And all it takes is like a part-time administrator who can be sent, the court can assign somebody who does the part-time scheduling work, so that these people go out at random to evaluate the conditions under which wards are kept. What is their state of mind? How are they? Is the house clean? I mean, there are cases where I actually spoke to a nurse who was doing private duty nursing for wards, and she said she preferred this one house over this other house because in this house it was fairly clean, but in the other house when she was walking, she was crunching on roaches. I was just horrified.
Oh my God.
When she had to give her patient something to drink, she had to brush the roaches off the cup. I thought, I can't believe this. And they're charging money for doing this? I cannot believe it.
A lot of money. It costs hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, no matter where you are, to have these people come into the home 24 hours a day. Hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
Yeah, it depends on what
the level
of care that they're offering. But it's still way overpriced for what it is. A lot of them refuse to cook. I mean, I've seen this and I've heard these stories. There are aides who come in who just sit and do nothing, or they go out in their car and they drink a soda, or they call their friends.
And meanwhile,
the ward is sitting in the house alone, can't get out, they're incapacitated in some way physically, and can't leave the house, and the aide's out there drinking and talking to their friends. And what is the aide doing?
Yes.
You brought up about a citizens committee to oversee this. We had a movement of sorts up here 3 to 4 years ago on exactly this thing, because the corruption in the courts here in Minnesota is just horrendous on any level. It's just terrible on a day-to-day basis. So this was brought up, that we couldn't get past this stinking bar association, and then we have the Judicial Review Board, which is absolutely worthless because they just act like the guard of the gate. You know, they're not going to let you go after one of their people. The only people they do go after is attorneys who try to blow the whistle on them, then they try to disbar them and run them out of business.
We've had experience with that down here, too. Big time.
Well, what they had wanted to do was set up a citizens committee that would oversee randomly, not just like probate or family court, but all the courts. They would just take various cases and take a look at what was going on and read the court transcripts and that kind of thing, and then they would render an opinion on it. This opinion would be binding. in the sense of, let's say, in a probate case, if they read a transcript and saw where someone's rights had been violated and their documents cast aside, they could write an opinion and say, you know, this person, you know, was at the mercy of this court who abused them terribly, and this all has to be set aside and all the money restored. They could have done this. The Bar Association and the Judicial Review Board up here absolutely stroked, and they were trying to negotiate, and what they wanted was, well, we could have a five-person panel, and three of those people could be citizens, but two of them would be attorneys or former judges, and they would guide the citizens through reading these transcripts, and they would help them compose a learned and interpreted meaning to what had transpired, because these poor, stupid, regular, everyday people just couldn't read these transcripts and figure out what had happened. That's just how stupid we are. They
I've actually
an ex-judge.
Seen transcripts where a judge says, "I won't listen to your side of the argument," to one of the participants.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Oh, we had our judge many times just refuse to take evidence, photographs, family photographs. He refused to allow family photographs into the courtroom because that might prejudice him and cause a mistrial, and then we would have to start all over again.
I'm not sure I can follow that logic at all.
Well, I hope
you sorry about
not.
That.
Well,
but
what's
I heard
wrong
that.
With you?
I hope you cannot follow that logic.
Well, first off, it isn't even a
problematic.
Yes. For those listening, if
with
anybody
respect.
Would like to call in, we are taking calls this evening. If you got any questions or comments for Leonie or Beverly, me, I'm just kind of hanging in the background here. The number is 917-388-4520, and please feel free to call in. Please confine, though, if you do, confine your call to questions or comments for our guest or for Beverly, our advocate. When you know, these stories, girls, are so ludicrous on their face. They, and I think this is part of the problem, you know, if you tell this to a person who hasn't come in contact with this mess, it does sound ludicrous, and the disbelief registers on their face, and the, well, that can't happen. Are you sure you understood right? Oh, I don't believe that. Until it happens to them. You know, and then they scream
exactly.
Bloody murder. We do have a caller here. If I can get this queued up.
Hello?
From area code 617. Did you have a question or comment for Leonie?
This is Lori Dubois.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to clarify what a lot of the members, victims, and... that's me. And... families don't know, and it's simply one of our NASCA slogans, which is, if you don't know your rights, you don't have any.
Yes.
At first.
Yes.
There are procedures in law which a judge is required to follow. If he doesn't, you have, well, really one choice, appeal. Appeal is a disgusting waste of time and money. As an activist, prior to my joining NASCA, I've learned that the discipline agencies aren't functioning properly and they need to be bombarded with complaints against the bad perps. Now, the problem, I'm going to be very, very frank, Marty. Our victims, our members, have Yahoo groups. They talk to each other. Elaine has put out calls for volunteers. I don't know what they're doing out there, but they're not working with us for reform. There are
that
many things we could be
problem.
Doing, but if it's not done under the banner, here's the other NASCA slogan, fight alone, fail alone.
Absolutely.
Yes.
One of the things Lori, that has happened in New Mexico is that through a series of fortunate events, a group of us have found each other because the secrecy is so is so strong here that people are not supposed to know how to find each other. They deliberately keep people separated, not only from their loved ones, but because all the cases are secret.
Right.
They can't find other people who are in a similar situation. So everybody feels isolated. And as individuals, you absolutely cannot fight this structure because it's a structure that's against you. There's a whole guardianship organization that's nationwide. The only organization that we have is NASCA. And people are, frankly, afraid to take action when their loved ones are alive because they're afraid of reprisals. And there are reprisals. I'm a witness
yes.
to it. I know other people who've had this done to them. Visitation is cut off. They're not allowed to communicate, even sometimes by telephone, with the person anymore. And there are very real threats out there. And I understand why people whose loved ones are still alive are living in fear.
At NASCA, we're very well aware of these problems all across the country. We're dealing with a bigger problem. It's that we have become a nation of the lawyers, by the lawyers, and for the lawyers.
Yes.
And what
That's
we
a
have
good way
to
of putting
do,
it.
Get out there, get as much media as we can, and pound away on the Internet. We
Love
have
that.
A lot of letter writing to Congress. They're just giving us lip service. Nothing realistic. However, because of the media that we've seen out there, some states are beginning to move slowly in the right direction. What we need, ladies and guys, if there are any, you've got to come together and work in committees under the NASCA banner if you want action. And then eventually, locally, you have to find each other, get out there face to face. I'm in Boston. I'm a former New Yorker, and we were out every chance we had demonstrating. Every time.
And where are you demonstrating? In
what,
front
what do
of
I
what?
Mean?
Where are you demonstrating?
At the courts.
At the courts themselves. Okay.
No, many years ago, before I got into guardianship, actually in 1994, a woman I knew was involved in a matrimonial. She refused to settle. And without notice to her, the judge put her in a guardianship. So we wrote a motion asking that the decision be voided for lack of notice and filed it and then followed it up with a demonstration at the courthouse. We were actually on the sidewalk facing the courthouse. A car pulled up, a guy got out, and he said, "Hey, you got a sign for me?" And the next day, the order was dissolved. That's action.
Amen, yes.
And that's
Excellent.
What we have to do after we do our work on the Internet. But we really need to get together in working committees. The basic problem is a lack of understanding of the law. There's an article you should dig out on the NASCA blog called Law 101. It talks about the elements of due process, the requirements for notice. And one of you mentioned earlier the problem, I think it was Marty mentioned the problem with advance directives. We had a case, I think it was in Illinois, where the guardian said the guardianship trumps those papers, something like that. Not true. The whole thing is all about understanding the law. In the case of the advance directives, you're dealing with a pro se, perhaps, who doesn't know the law, or you're dealing with an elder lawyer who practices before the same judge and won't go against the judge. If you knew your rights, as an honest lawyer, you would know to put on a notice, demand for a hearing, as to the, the documents being effective at a time prior to incapacitation. And another thing I always recommend is now when you're executing, having those documents executed, that should be videotaped. So that can be used as evidence at such a hearing. The judge has the authority to put on a hearing, what they call sua sponte, on his own motion, but they won't do it.
No.
And if your lawyer is, pardon me, kissing the judge's butt, he won't do it either.
We
so
file
about knowing the law and knowing your rights.
We
sometimes, even if you know the law and your rights, if you have a judge who is clearly biased, you won't get your rights vindicated. Your rights
will not
be respected.
You will not get a hearing. We didn't get a hearing. We had a dozen motions
that
cited the law.
Okay, well, when you get localized, as you find your other victims in the local area, the next thing you do is what we did in New York, court watching. You have to have people go in there to intimidate the judge.
Okay, you're not allowed to do that in New Mexico. In fact,
they even
throw journalists out of these hearings. That's one of the problems with a sequestered case, which is what all guardianship hearings are in New Mexico, is exactly that almost everyone is excluded from the courtroom.
There is a doctrine in the law.
And no visitors are allowed.
In fact, even a
journalist from the Albuquerque Journal was invited by one of the attorneys because he wanted a witness to one of these guardianship hearings. The judge saw this journalist in the courtroom, said, "Who are you? What are you doing here? You don't belong here. You're a journalist. Get out.
Okay.
Or I'll hold you in contempt," and wouldn't allow the journalist to remain in the courtroom.
Well, hold on, it's fine if it's allowed, but what we need to do
is change the law so that it's possible to monitor these situations. Right now, it's not possible. The only people who are even allowed access to the transcripts of the hearings are the interested parties in the case, and sometimes some of them they make attempts to bar them from getting the records.
Hold on.
We have another caller on from area code 505 who has been waiting quite some time patiently, and I want to give them a chance to ask their question or speak. Do you have a question or comment for our guest?
Marty, I'm usually asleep at this hour. This is a first for me, and I can't contain myself.
Okay, that's all right. That's all right. Go ahead, 505.
I'm from New Mexico, and I can tell you that, and I was with Leonie during this incident with the journalist. And New Mexico is famous for not allowing any dissent. I mean, the Office of Guardianship that was instituted a few years ago, the head of the guardianship office was sued to make the meetings public. And then he said, "Okay, I'll do that, but I'm not telling anybody when these things are." You know, so that's the kind of mentality we have in New Mexico.
What I'm telling you, this is just absolutely
dead.
It infuriates me. It, honest to God, this is one subject that absolutely, for all the talking I do, which is chronic and continual, that just leaves me speechless.
You know, for me, I am just an observer of all this. A friend of mine is going through it. They've spent a ton of money, you know, various things, and I started researching. And started realizing that nationally speaking, this is a huge deal. I mean, the more I dug, the dirtier I got.
So I started a website.
I mean, not a website, a Facebook page. And my goal was simply to collect research and just to put it somewhere where I could have it. And, you know, it's great because Facebook, you can post a link to whatever you're looking at, right? Well, it started to grow and people started participating. And in two months, we have 8,000 people who are fans of the page.
Wow.
So what I really believe is that the Internet is a different kind of news because, number one, it's interactive, and number two, you can slam people with this stuff every single day. And I think the other thing that we did that was right was we put it under elder abuse in general, and then when people came to the page, they got these horrific stories about the law abusing people, and the people who were appointed by the law abusing people, and that shocked them even more because they're used to hearing about physical or emotional abuse, maybe even financial abuse, but they aren't used to hearing about an entire tag team of somebody posted today. He had the guardian's schedule of fees that was in his case, and he listed everything word for word. You know, he just posted it up there, a copy. And there were 15 people being paid about $100 each an hour, and I totaled it all up, and it would amount to $1,300 an hour. 15
wow.
people on the payroll.
Oh, my God.
I saw a listing in which there was a $10 charge for writing a check.
Oh, yeah, that was on
a
there.
A single check.
Oh, ours is 15. Our guardian charge is 15.
It's not funny, but it's weird.
Absolutely.
I mean, this stuff was unbelievable. I think Leonie has sent you a copy of it, but it's unbelievable.
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Just outrageous, you know. And somebody said, gee, I hope that's per month. And I said, no, actually, it would be $1,300 a day if those people only work for 1 hour. All those
I've seen
this
start
hour.
At like $55 an hour for clerical services. And it
oh,
went
yeah.
up there.
Right.
Well,
and
it occurs to me.
I've even heard of cases where one person found out another was getting more than they were, and they complained that they weren't getting $115 an hour. You know.
It seems to me that having morals and ethics can somehow work against you financially. Who in good conscience could do this? I just, of course, they're again looking
at it. That's what I don't get. How can
they don't have any conscience?
Well, one thing you know is that by producing this wonderful example for their children and their relatives, you know that they will have created people who are going to do to them what they've done to our relatives.
Yeah.
And
so at least you know that that much justice is likely to come about eventually. But actually one of the worst things about the secrecy is that nobody knows how many people there are. It's as if these people have been disappeared.
Well,
you know, as used to happen in Argentina or one of the countries where they just vanished and were never heard from again. When I was at this meeting, there was a meeting with one of the state senators earlier this week on Tuesday, and he's the one who's sponsoring this particular SB 112.
Right.
And a number of us met with him to try to get him to change some of the provisions. And he didn't know. 2 weeks before that, another state senator had a town hall. He said that he knew there were 2,400 people.
Right. Yeah, I was
New
the
Mexico.
One who was talking to him.
And when we were at this meeting with the other state senator, he said there were 10,000 people under guardianship in New Mexico. He provided
well,
us with a paper
children.
That's called a financial impact statement or financial impact report from the Legislative Council Service, which is the group that the legislature delegates to make reports and analyses of each bill that comes before the legislature to talk about, you know, how it would affect. It's kind of like an environmental impact statement, but for the citizens of the state rather than the environment. And we got to the part on that report where it said how much it's going to impact the citizenry. And there was a big question mark. It said, we don't know how many people there are. Well, the next time I heard a number quoted, it was 1,000 developmentally disabled folks who were under guardianship, but that's different from the people who are elders who are under guardianship. So
yes.
If you take the 10,000 wards who are under guardianship in New Mexico, and only 1,000 of those are developmentally disabled, it means 9,000 elderly would be in guardianships in New Mexico. And there are altogether 33 firms doing any work with the disabled, with the elder group, with the elder community. So there would be hundreds and hundreds of people attached to each of these firms, if that's true.
Yeah. Now, 400,
you 500?
Have,
I mean, it's amazing. They couldn't
internet,
possibly care properly for that number of people with
Leonie,
the number of guardianship, commercial guardianship firms there are.
Leonie, on the internet, do you have for the state of Mexico a roster of all of your registered or certified or licensed, I don't know what it is called in New Mexico, guardians? Because we do.
Yes, there
and we
is.
Have
it's a guardianship
hundreds.
Organization. And it's the I'll have to look for the name of it for you, but if anybody wants to write in, I'll give them that information.
Okay.
I've got an email address, which is rosensti63@gmail.com, and I'll be glad to look that up and send that to anybody. But it
well,
is a guardianship association. I believe it's called
the
New Mexico Guardianship
Association. No, I'm talking about the people that the the state of New Mexico actually either registers or licenses or certifies to be serving as guardians in that state, professional or public guardians, because we have that on the internet, and it's listed by county. Each one is able to practice in, you know, X number of counties, and there are hundreds of names, hundreds, and yet our attorney general and the inspector general for the entire state and the inspector general for the Department of Elder Affairs all say that they have no jurisdiction over these hundreds of guardians that are practicing in the state of Florida. That's exactly the terminology they use. No jurisdiction.
Well, I know that a number of people who've been harmed by the guardianship system have gone to our attorney general as well and have gotten absolutely no satisfaction from him. And part of the reason is that, in general, the people they're complaining against specifically are people who helped him write the guardianship manual for New Mexico.
Exactly. And that's what we have. We have the president of the National Association of Elder Law Attorneys who has received complaints, serious, serious, serious complaints with evidence attached. And all they say is we don't have any jurisdiction to enforce the laws of the state of Florida with respect to guardians.
I have a question for you about Florida, because something that's going on in Florida is about to happen possibly in New Mexico, and that is there's a bill 271 from the Senate that is proposing pretty much a similar thing that the Baker laws do in Florida.
Yeah.
And what's scary about that is that, you know, what they're proposing is that you don't have to be a psychiatrist to make an evaluation that sends someone into the mental hospital for 72 days for further evaluation.
72 hours.
No, I said 72 hours.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's 72 hours,
it's
which is an eternity.
It's 72 hours,
these poor
feels
people.
Like 72 days.
Well,
the problem is, how do guardians... Okay, so I wrote this letter to the editor, and my suggestion was that what could happen, just in a scenario, is that a guardian who's not a psychiatrist could deem somebody needed an evaluation, get them into the hospital, then file for an emergency petition for guardianship, and then just have that person all sewn up.
Absolutely. Now,
Does that happen in Florida?
In my father's case, they did just the reverse. First, they got the guardianship in an emergency petition with, of course, not notifying me and not listing me on any of the documents, which right then and there was fraud before the court. But immediately when they found out that I found out about the guardianship through a completely independent source, not through anyone connected with the state of Florida, and I was coming down to rescue my father, they put him henceforth into the Baker Act. Now, as bad as guardianship is, and it is really horrendous in far too many cases, guardianship plus the Baker Act is unspeakable.
That's right.
And my father had guardianship, Baker Act, plus a no-contact order in the Baker Act. So here's an 89-year-old Holocaust survivor who has been ripped out of his home, thrown into a nursing home against all of his advance directives, and then thrown into a metropolitan hospital in a basement, in a really dingy, ugly basement, locked up there for 3 weeks, no representation, no habeas corpus, and no hearings.
Unbelievable.
Absolutely against the law.
So,
our attorney general says she can do nothing.
So this combination
with respect.
Beverly, I'd like to get your opinion on something, because I spoke to an attorney after I heard about this 271. I contacted an attorney that I respect who used to practice in Florida. And he said that he had been responsible for getting people sprung from this Baker Act situation. And he said that their MO basically was to put people in the institution, then to drug them. After they were drugged, they would bring in someone to evaluate.
Right.
And
yes.
of course, they could not perform when they were drugged.
Yes.
And so they would then say the person was incompetent.
Absolutely.
Okay, everyone, we have a caller waiting. Again, it's been waiting some
time. Thank you
very
much. I'm departing. Bye. Thank you so much.
Bye. Thank you
Bye-bye.
So much
Bye.
For calling. We've got someone, and it's a blind number. I can't tell who this is, so you're the last caller up if you have a question or comment.
Hi, Marty.
Hello.
How are you? It's Angela.
Hi, Angela.
I have some good news to share.
Yes.
We're going to federal court, and we are suing three of the judges because they acted out of jurisdiction. And so they are individually responsible for what happened in my case.
Oh, you're kidding.
And how did they act out of jurisdiction?
If this case prevails, this can set precedent everywhere because this is federal court.
Yes.
And they accepted the suit?
It's just getting ready to get filed. It's being filed next week. You're the first
okay.
to know.
Okay. And where can we ask where you're filing at?
In Florida.
In Florida. Okay. Okay. My God.
You know, right?
Yes. What I'm very interested in is finding out if the court will actually accept it. Not that I don't mean that to imply that your case does not have merit. I know that it does. But what I am saying is, will the court accept it, allow you to sue these judges regardless of what you've got? Because most times what happens is they dismiss it. They won't hear it. And they'll find out either you have no standing or your hair's not the right color.
Oh,
you didn't
well, no,
use the
I
right
have an
way.
Attorney. I have
mm-hmm.
This is not done pro se.
Okay.
In fact,
well,
I have two attorneys.
I'm just saying, but usually they won't accept any cases that go against a judge for any reason. We couldn't even get the Supreme Court when William Windsor sued the district court in Atlanta, Georgia, because it is so blatantly corrupt, and got it all the way to the Supreme Court. SCOTUS said that the corruption in the lower courts were not of a concern to them. And they dismissed it. And so this is kind of what we're facing on all levels, even if you can get out of these stinking probate courts, unless you're filing criminal charges. Is that in essence what you did, Angela?
I know he's filing under 42, 1983, 1985, and 1988. And we're also suing the banks, too.
Well, I think
in my
civil
case,
rights, isn't it?
Are you filing?
Part of it is, yeah. No, well, 85 has to do with conspiracy, but he doesn't
yes.
mention RICO. He said RICO the judges don't really believe, so he's not going there. He's a very seasoned attorney, and he already won on a very similar case. He's out of state, and he
okay.
already won for another client
I
on a very
say,
similar case.
I was
going
to say, where did you get a Florida attorney who would file?
Yeah, I had to go out of state. He's from Ohio, and he won on a very similar thing where they took payable on death accounts and turned them into guardianship accounts and then used it to absolutely fleece the estate.
Oh, my God.
So I'm real curious
sorry, I didn't
to see what's
they did
happen.
What to guardianship accounts?
Everything
they
was
mixed funds
the
or
bank
something?
Payable on death to me. Everything was payable on death. So they took the accounts and they destroyed the payable on death designation and they declared $750,000 to be guardianship assets. And then my mother was dead within 3 months, and then they kept the guardianship open for 4 years and continued
oh,
to pay
God.
Themselves.
Now, I have a question. With the payable on death, doesn't the bank itself have to cooperate with that?
Right.
I
mean, we're suing the banks as
well.
The banks,
okay.
the judges,
okay,
the guardian, and her attorneys
because
are
I
all
know
thrown into this lawsuit.
Our guardian went to a foreign bank, you know, an out-of-state bank, and withdrew over $36,000, almost $37,000, and had no legal authority to do that. And we still have the bonds in our hands
but we don't have the funds.
Oh, I have a case right now that I've been working on where the guardian, I guess you don't want me to mention her, she didn't report $40 million. $40 million on one case.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Well, the guardian you're talking about, Angela, they've contacted me by email 3 times with cease and desist, threatening to sue me for mentioning that lovely woman's name, who in 2007 was totally bankrupt straight across the board and at this point in time is a multimillionaire many times over, and the only job she has had.
$40 million just from one case, Marty. $40 million from just one case.
And that's in Florida.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, you're in luck in Florida if you're a guardian, because there's no one has jurisdiction over you. You just
I have to tell you that New Mexico in that regard, because a lot of our guardians are social workers. And one of these social workers who is known to have had a number of false statements in different cases that she made to the court about various individuals who were related to the wards, she was disciplined by the social work board and her license was taken away. Various people have tried to find out, because this happened in district court, the social work board sued her in district court and stripped her of her license. Well, you would think that because it was a district court proceeding, you would be able to find out about it, but they have sequestered that entire proceeding, and several people who tried to get those records have been unable to do so. And you would think, if this is a person who is still running a guardianship company, So she's still ahead of a guardianship company. She just doesn't have her social work license anymore for reasons unknown. There must have been some reason why they took the license away from her.
Exactly.
Well, that's exactly it. So what you're saying is that you can still, in the state of Florida, retain your ability to be a guardian without even having your license to be a social worker, or any other, really, credentials, no matter
apparently
what you've done.
So, and one of the things that I'm finding out, because right now I'm doing research for a television documentary about this problem, and that is that a lot of the time you will find that a lot of these people have 2, 3, and 4 mortgages on their homes. Mm-hmm. A lot of the principals in these firms. And you say, well, okay, they specialize in taking care of people who have a certain amount of money. Isn't that putting them in the way of excess temptation? If they're so heavily in debt themselves, this is not a good thing. So one of the things that needs to be changed in the law is either they post bond, or they put a piece of the estate in escrow, or they have to certify to the court every year that they're absolutely solvent and have no reason to want to harm the ward financially.
I don't see any problem with that, and the reason I don't is a joke under the circumstances. But the reason I don't see any problem with that, what you have just stated there, is if you go to work for any corporation in any capacity, generally, they want to review your credit history. They want to see how you've managed your money. I personally don't think that's any of their business, but they do it nonetheless. And people, will turn over their credit history. They will turn over credit card accounts that they've got, their bank statements, everything, in order to get that job. Nobody has a job I want that damn bad. But they'll do it nonetheless. So if it is acceptable.
I can understand that, but I would want them. Yeah. I would want to know that someone who is taking care of somebody I care about is not going to fleece them because they're insolvent.
Suppose, in this capacity, when you are dealing with someone else's money, and someone else's lifetime savings and things they have accrued, then yes, you have an obligation to say, I'm on the up and up, and I have a clean financial record. I don't have any ulterior motives for getting into this other than to take care of this person. And so in this situation, and because of the way this all goes all the time, this fleecing of the victim, the looting of the estate, I think it is imperative that we put these kind of controls in there. Speaking about this one particular predator that's at work down there in Sarasota, Florida, somebody should have taken a look and seen that this woman, I mean, after the first couple of years, after filing an abject bankruptcy, absolutely being totally wiped out, and a few years later she's a multimillionaire, and all she's done is supposedly been a guardian for the elderly. Well, where did that money come from? Because that job obviously pays way more than I thought it did. And, you've got to, and there are situations, and this is one of them, where that's very relevant, it's very pertinent, and it should be a matter of course, that this is what takes place. But, of course, if you bring this up, if you, you know, would suggest this, the shock, oh, how could you? How could you?
Actually, our laws do demand a credit history and a criminal check, and I believe they're supposed to do it every single year. But again, where is the enforcement arm? What happens if, let's say, your credit is very, very bad? Is there anything that requires the state to take away your registration as a guardian? And as far as I can tell, there is no enforcement mechanism whatsoever in the vast majority of guardianship law in the state of Florida. No enforcement mechanism.
I haven't seen any in New Mexico either. I want to go back to this conflict of interest question that was raised a minute ago. And one of the reasons why there's such a huge conflict of interest in New Mexico is because of the secrecy, because when you go into a hearing like that and it's closed to everybody except the principals, and sometimes even the prospective ward's not allowed to attend the hearing if there's a hearing. Sometimes it's declared without a hearing, and sometimes when there is a hearing, the ward is not allowed to be present. So all the people who are there would be the attorney for the ward, the court visitor, the guardian ad litem. If there's a second attorney for the individual, there's an attorney for the person who's bringing the action. And those would be the only people in the room, unless the person who's bringing the action's in the room. So what you have is, if they can't decide, or if there's any dissension in the family, all the family isn't completely in agreement, or if they think there's too much money and they don't want a family member to handle it, the judge then has to appoint a guardian because the person's judged incapacitated. So who is the judge going to appoint? She or he will appoint whoever's sitting in the room because there's nobody else there they can see. And very often the person will say, "Your Honor, I was the court visitor, or I was the guardian ad litem, and I must note for the record that there's a conflict of interest." And the judge says, "So noted," and you're appointed anyway.
Yes.
Wow. That's just why I
now
say
that's
this is
if
such...
you have a transcript to look at. Most hearings actually do not get transcribed. Depending upon the length of the hearing, obviously, it can cost hundreds of dollars to get a hearing transcribed. So you're talking about not only a closed courtroom, but you're talking about no written record of that hearing whatsoever, other than the petitions and the order that the court signs, but not actually a written record of the hearing itself.
Well, one of the things that I discovered recently is that a lot of our hearings are actually recorded.
Yes.
And that recording is kept in the record. They may not transcribe it, but the recording itself is evidence of what happened at the hearing. And even if it's not transcribed, if you hear something that's radically wrong with that hearing, if you listen to the recording, if you're able to get a recording, you listen to that recording and you find something horribly wrong with the process or horribly wrong with the actions taken that don't accord with the evidence at all, then you do have some kind of recourse, but it is awfully expensive to get
you
a transcript.
You still have to, at least in every court I've been in, actually pay for the transcript. You cannot just hand the judge a disc that has a recording on it. So
I've never tried to do that, so I don't know exactly what the protocol is for that in New Mexico.
I have heard actual recordings
of some people's hearings.
But have you heard them in court presented as evidence?
No. Of course, I wouldn't be able to go to those proceedings,
so I wouldn't know what's presented there.
I've never heard it in one of the recordings that somebody says, Your Honor, I'd like to play for you the recording of such and such a hearing. I've never heard of that. But
we had to pay every time, and we still do, for the transcripts. First, we have to pay for the recording. And then we have to pay.
Well, the recording in New Mexico is something like $4. So that's not a big deal. The transcript's very expensive, though.
Yes. And around here, most of your transcripts run at least $4 a page. So, you know, you could easily run up $400 for a relatively short hearing. And if you have
Absolutely, but there's something very interesting, and that is a friend of mine clued me into this one, and that is that very often if you get a copy of the actual recording of the session and you look at the transcript, they're not the same.
Correct.
Nope. Exactly.
It depends upon the transcriptionist, and you better check really closely to make sure that the transcriptionist who did that particular hearing transcribed it correctly.
You know, when you talk about recording in a courtroom, this is supposed to be taking place in every courtroom in the country. And Lisa, our friend out there in Boston, she was has been through the court several times trying to rescue her father, and she herself is an attorney. She said in these courts, she said that is controlled up at the judge's bench. And
That's true.
And every time he was going to violate rights or do something unlawful, illegal, from the bench, he would shut that off.
Yes.
Oh, man.
And she said, and then when they would continue.
And many times there are discussions, really important discussions, that go on after a hearing is off the record. So the recording is no longer on, or the court reporter is told, if you hire a court reporter, the court reporter is told by the judge off the record. And then the discussions go on, so you not only don't have the recording, you do not have the court reporter even transcribing while she is there in the courtroom being paid by you.
This is just so sick. I can't stand it. I don't know. And see, what I'm seeing here is we need, and people keep saying, well, we have to go to the federal government and get a blanket law on the federal level to straighten all this out. I disagree. For one thing, you're not going to get anything out of those people. It's got to be done in each and every state. We need what they call model state legislation, and that means enacted in each state. The holding accountable of these judges, no one should have immunity. I don't care if you take a public job, you take the risk associated with that, and you do so with the knowledge that certain things are expected of you, and especially in a legal, lawful courtroom capacity. There are certain things expected of you. You are expected to abide by the law. You are expected to respect people's rights. You're expected to hear evidence and allow people to speak. And when you don't do that, you've lost any right to hold that chair. And you should not be off limits simply because you wear in a black robe and dress like a woman. I just don't like the idea of that. And nobody should be, okay, let's go again to this Bar Association. The Bar Association can license no one to practice law. They can't. You get that from the school you attend. You pass that, you're ready to practice law. You don't need a permit from the Bar Association, but they have it locked up in every state, I think, except three. There's three states that won't allow a Bar Association. But we need to get rid of, bust up. These are closed union shops, and that's exactly what they are. This is a union, and it works to prevent these people from being held accountable for their misdeeds, for breaking the law, for abusing their clients, for ripping them off, and this is all that they do. They just run interference. They are also the same people who select those judges you were talking about that are on your ballot. That's why there's only one on there.
Or
they
the
are
party.
The persons. Yes.
They have political parties that are selecting the judges, so it's also a very political position in many places.
Well, it's just there's several things that need to happen here. And the other thing is the curtailing of this predatory activity. If you're going to be you think you want to be a guardian, a conservator, whatever you want to call it, then you should have to supply background checks. You should have to supply a credit history. And if your income takes a jump of a couple million in a year, and all you've done is been guardian for 2 or 3 or 4 or 10 people, somebody needs to look at where that money came from. How did
but
you acquire all
that? But who is the person? We have no one here. We have an entire state government that absolutely has washed its hands of hundreds and hundreds of guardians. Just washed its hands. You know, we have the books on the law, no enforcement mechanism, and who's going to make that decision that you're no longer going to be a guardian? Under the law, the executive director of the Department of Elder Affairs, at least in this state of Florida, can make the decision to rescind or revoke or suspend the registration of a guardian. But to the best of my knowledge, that has never happened, or if it has, it certainly is not something that would be public knowledge. So who's going to make the decision?
They're going to protect themselves, which is what they do here too. Again, anybody who would try to blow a whistle would be ostracized. They would lose all their referrals. And it also extends to psychiatrists. There are sometimes psychiatrists who will email the guardian and say, this is the draft of my report. Please correct it. Change it how you like. And then I'll submit it.
Well, you know what the reason for that is, Leonie? Have you heard about the DSM that's coming out, number 5?
Oh, yeah, everything's going to be an illness by now.
Everything's an illness. Us doing this radio show will be, you know, talking too much on the radio disorder. that's how stupid this thing is. And the other thing is, it says right in there, by their own admission, there is no science, there is no tests, no testing. There is nothing but their subjective observance that a mental disorder even exists. And because there is nothing to validate scientifically what they are claiming, they should never testify in a courtroom because they have nothing to back up what they're saying other than their own speculation. So the idea that these people are called in, are asked to make reports, are giving out medication, are doing anything, is especially in this narrow venue, is absolutely ridiculous. When you look at in Florida there, and it was another good case, those psychiatrists down there with the foster children that they were leasing out to the pharmaceutical companies to test vaccines and psychotropic drugs on, several of them died. That's the only way they got this busted up. Here, they said 4 out of 5 foster children had been leased out because you're a unit. You become a ward of the state. You lose all your rights. You cease to exist as a human being. And so they were considered a unit. They were leased out to the pharmaceutical companies, literally, for experimentation. And several of these children died with multiple drugs in them. And they finally busted this up, put several psychiatrists in prison, which is right where they should have been for life. And but it's not going to bring these children back. These are the same people that are okaying and administering these psychotropic drugs to the elderly that are not approved for use on them. And every time they get caught doing that, it's another thing that needs to be addressed here. Any psychiatrist or medical doctor that stands by, approves, or suggests the use of these unapproved drugs on the elderly should have their damn license jerked immediately. But it's never going to happen. Too much money.
You know, on our front page of the Bradenton newspaper, there's a huge headline mental health screenings urged for freshmen. Local expert tells fellow community leaders the initiative would identify problems early. So here we are sitting on a state in which people are being held against their will and against their law, especially elders, and now we have our community leaders entertaining and seriously considering screening, mandatory screening of every single freshman student in the entire state for mental health.
Do you have any idea how many of those kids are going to end up medicated?
Absolutely.
All of them.
We have five
bills coming up in the Minnesota legislature.
Yes.
They're on the schedule now, and all of them deal with mental health screening, but they want to go clear back down to elementary school.
Yes.
Recently, one of my granddaughters was having these teen screen questionnaires at the doctor's office, which I promptly jerked out of her hand and threw away. And when they asked me why she couldn't fill that out, I said, because the questions are skewed. Have you felt sad in the last week? Did you cry? Have you been upset? Have you had a headache? Does your parent or guardian use drugs? Do they use alcohol? You know, are you feeling
highly
sad
invasive
now? And yes, they are. And so, and I've informed the school that my girls are not to fill out any surveys, questionnaires, anything else, nothing.
And that's what they're going to use as the springboard for not only pharmaceuticals, psychotropics, but it will be the springboard for mandatory psychiatric counseling for years. I mean, we're talking about a fortune that a family might be saddled with to pay, or Medicare or Medicaid, however, you know, it would come down in order to have children undergo treatments that, for the most part, they don't need. And
no.
We live in a society in which the kids are bombarded with messages that are totally abnormal.
Yes.
And yet,
one of the big problems, I think, is that they don't want people to have normal human emotions.
That's correct.
Everybody's got a range of emotions. We all exhibit them at different times. Sometimes we're happy. Sometimes we're sad. Heaven forbid, sometimes we're angry, too. And
yep.
We're not allowed to have those emotions. We're only supposed to be happy all the time. And if
well,
we're not happy
thing,
all the time, then they need to medicate us.
And
so
then
we
they call it
happiness
disorder.
One
I
of
imagine.
The big problems
yeah.
with a lot of the people under guardianship in New Mexico is that when their relatives are allowed to visit them, they're sad when the relatives leave. The guardian takes
yeah.
that as being evidence that seeing the relatives makes the person sad.
Oh,
and
yes.
says,
oh.
We don't want you to come anymore because you upset our ward. Well, they're
oh,
sad because
yeah.
their relatives are leaving. That's not strange.
Well, the thing is with all of this and, like, starting this in early childhood, I mean, for God's sake, we've got liquid Prozac for babies now. And because they cry, and the babies cry.
They've done
I'm
that for a long huge, time.
Yeah,
yeah
I noticed that.
I cry on a regular basis there. And but anyway, so they got that. But what they're doing is creating lifetime patients.
Yes.
You know, this is like futures marketing. We are creating lifetime patients. We are training
yes.
these children that they don't have to solve their problems. They don't have to work through issues. They don't have to be responsible for comforting themselves, making themselves feel better. That if, that, you know, the boy you like doesn't like you back, it's not, you know, time for suicide. It just means he doesn't like you. Get over it. There's another one. And But this is what we're doing. We're creating these lifetime patients, and we are training these children to believe.
And
that
Marty,
the only way, yes,
their lifetime income streams.
Yes, betcha.
I know,
that's,
but you're what you're training
their value.
People to do is not to live, but to take pills.
Yes,
yes. Take a pill. Don't manage anything. These kids end up, or, and many of them already have, end up not knowing how to cope with the simplest thing. Because somebody gave them a pill before and said, you don't have to. The other sad part of this is that every bit of this, every one of these questionnaires, every one of these surveys, every meeting with the therapist, whatever the medication you were on, will be part of your personal history for the rest of your life.
Absolutely.
It will follow you wherever you go. And this is, I've told kids, don't answer any questions. Stick to the subject at hand. They tried here recently to give them what they called a blind survey, and the kid said, well, there wasn't, you know, any identifying information. It was on the computer. I said, was there a barcode? Yes. I said, your name and address and age and birth date was in there. They know exactly who you are. I told you, don't do this. And I'm telling you, but it is a concerted effort, and I think a lot of this use of these drugs on the elderly is in anticipation of what the future is going to be like as a result of these kids being drugged now. That and the pharmaceutical companies, when we see them manufacturing things like Zyprexa, Seroquel, Xanax, you know, Risperdal, Haldol, all of these things, these are not engineered to help anyone. They are engineered to be highly addictive. They are a prescription street drug. And that's what they were manufactured for.
And I had students on some of those drugs also when they would have a bad day. They would say to me, well, you know what? I must have missed my pills today. You know, it was already ingrained in their heads, and certainly not by me, because I never supported drugging the kids, ever. But it was ingrained in their heads that they were going to have a bad day if they did not take the pill. Their pill was the ticket to success.
Oh, my God.
How
and
old are these kids?
That's a very, very distorted view of the world that is being generated from the time many of these kids are toddlers, that they cannot navigate the world unless they are on drugs.
How old are the kids you were dealing with?
I had kids that were all the way from preschool through high school. And the kids in elementary to middle school age would definitely say to you, point blank, I'm having a bad day. I must have missed, or I did miss, my medication today.
Oh, for God's sake. Girls, I hate to say it, but we're down to just under 2 minutes here. Leonie, I want to thank you so much for coming on. This has just been a tremendous talk here this evening.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and anybody who wants to get in touch with me, just write to my email address, and I'll be glad to answer you.
You want to give that out again, Leonie?
Sure, rosensti63@gmail.com.
Okay, and thank you so much. We'll be checking back with you, too, to see how things go there in New Mexico. Beverly,
thank you very much. Appreciate your interest in it.
As always, Beverly, thank you for co-hosting and throwing your 2 cents worth in there. It makes it very interesting. And for everyone who was signed in and called in, I appreciate it so much. These shows get bigger each week, and hopefully, eventually, we'll get enough people together here that we can make a difference. I don't know what else I can do here. If anybody's got any suggestions, any ideas, write me at ppj1@hush.com, and we'll go from there. I'm willing to entertain just about anything at this point in time, because I really don't think I can take much more of this. I've got a short fuse and a bad temper, and I think it blew quite a while back. So, like I say, anybody's got any ideas, suggestions, got anything you think I could do to help this cause out, let me know. In the meantime, we'll be back next Sunday night with a new show, and Lord knows what will happen between now and then. But
Marty,
anything,
I have a suggestion. Just keep your eye on the ball, and we have to make sure our focus is getting those wards safe, not being angry, because they don't need anger. They need persistence.
Well, that too. We're down to the end here, ladies. Thank you, everyone. And like I say, we'll be back next week with more on guardianship abuse. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.